back to history. We did have one question about history about Leo, and whether or not when he asked the Western emperor for the control over the church in the West, whether or not he specifically was asking for all control in the West, right? Or if he was just kind of going to the emperor asking for control in general. Like, he thought maybe it would have been broader or maybe even more specific than that. I couldn't find anything that addressed it specifically, but my sense of it was, as I read through, Leo A, he really, really believed that a strong, centralized government for the church was the best way to run the church. It was the best way to ferret out heresy. It was the best way to get people appointed. And he was in a government that had a strong, centralized leader, an emperor. You don't get more strong and more centralized than an emperor, right? So that was the way of government of his day. And he actually uses an argument, first among equals. Has anyone ever heard that phrase before? Caesar uses that argument. It's one of the first times we have it recorded. Caesar uses that argument when he's trying to argue the Roman Senate away from a republic and towards him being appointed an emperor, which he does, right? So you can see in Leo that Leo really does believe that there should be one person at the top, and when he makes that request of the Emperor of the West, he really is looking for all the power in the West, but he's not just power hungry. I want to emphasize that. I am not down on Leo. I like Leo. He's Leo the Great, by the way, one of only three people that will get the moniker the Great. He is probably a tad narcissistic at times. But he's smart, and he keeps a lot of people alive, and he does some good for the church, right? So I'm not down on Leo. I don't think this is just a power grab. I think he genuinely thinks it's the best way for the church. I disagree with him, but he thinks it's the best way for the church. So that is the question that we had last week. Well, Leo is not only famous for what he does inside the church, he's famous for what he does outside the church. We talked about this a little bit last week in that he negotiated with two groups. Anybody remember what those two groups were? They were the Huns,
the
Vandals, close, starts with a V. And we'll talk about the Visigoths later. The Huns and the Vandals. So, and the Huns are big. Okay, they are, if you look at this map I've given you, the Huns are a group that come from what we would consider Russia, down into Northeast Europe. And when they come down into Northeast Europe, they set off what is later called the Great Migration, like BBs, especially in Germany. I don't know if you've ever knocked over a box of BBs or ever spilled BBs. Like, somehow BBs end up in the top floor of the house when you spill them downstairs. They defy physics, and you're never going to get them all back in the box again, right? That sort of thing happens as soon as the Huns kind of come crashing through Europe. So who are the Huns? Well, first off, they're kind of a loosely associated group of tribes. Until Attila comes along. And when Attila comes along, he gives them organization. He's able, as a charismatic military leader, he's able to organize what is supposedly only half of the Huns and form an army of 500,000 people strong. 500,000. That is huge. By the way, that is the same size as our modern U.S. Army. 500,000. And yet they say, I don't know if we have any people who are army or were army, they say that for every combat soldier, there are 9 men that are in support of that one combat soldier. These would have been 500,000 warriors, right? So this is an incredibly large force, difficult to stop, and you can see why when they come through, people just scatter. By the time the West runs into them, they're located in a region that is called the Hunnic region. Okay, it's also the same reason why when that same region, more than a millennia later, fights for its own independence, it's given the name Hungary. Right? Same place. Okay, and it's named not because of some sort of genetic relation, so don't go up to anybody you know who's Hungarian and go, "Ah, Attila!" Right? No, they're not related. Right? It's named that way because of the region itself, the geographic region. But by the time the Romans run into them, that's where they are. Then they come down into Europe and they set people off. They're known for their horseback riding archers specifically. So their archers are very good. They're very mobile. They're very effective. And Rome is not set up, and the West is not set up to handle something like that. It's like modern day escalation to the chariot, really. Really interesting that the way they even dressed mattered, because they wore, instead of wearing armor like the Romans did, they just wore a silk robe or a silk shirt. And what happened is that if you actually shot one of these guys with an arrow, the silk would wrap around the arrowhead as it went in. So it's very easy to get out, and it minimized the damage. Versus a Roman who had armor, and when it went in, the armor actually broke off the shaft, and it was hard to get out. More than likely, you were going to die. So they were militarily much further ahead than the West was, and they really didn't expect them. So they come in. Attila leads them, and they sack the East and the West. That is, that they come in, they lay siege. The East tries to fight them. The East can't, and so they Attila demands tribute, demands payment. And so you got to keep in mind that Attila has such a large force. He's actually fighting on two different fronts. Okay, the East-West Empire is just one front that he's fighting on. So he'll go back to this other front. He'll come down. He'll conquer the Roman Empire, lay tribute on them, and then he'll go back and he'll fight on this other front. Well, what happens is the East doesn't pay. They say, oh, yeah, I mean, he's at the doors, right? And everybody's going to die. Oh, we'll pay. Whatever you want, we'll pay, right? And then he leaves, and they go, just kidding, right? And they don't pay. And so what does Attila do? He comes back. And he comes back, and he burns more cities. By the way, this is why Venice was created. Venice was created in a marshy area. It was not quite as underwater as it is now. It's because the Huns weren't set up to do water warfare. So you were safe in Venice. Okay. So the Huns come back through. They burn, and they're noted for burning towns to the ground, just raising them, ashes, and that's it, right? Take off with their money and then raise the town, really to make a statement to those around them that you need to deal with us, right? We're serious. They come back, they raise some more cities, the East and West try to put up a fight again, and they're defeated pretty handily, and they go, okay, we give uncle, right? And they go, okay, here's tribute, right? Okay, more than it was last time, and a fine for breaking the treaty. So he leaves. Guess what the empire does? They don't pay, right? So he comes back a third time. This is when Leo is sent. So he's on his way back for a third time. He's in northern Italy, and the Western Emperor, who is based now at a town called Ravenna in northeast Italy, it is also kind of a marshy region, makes it hard for the Huns and the Vandals to get to him. He sends three emissaries to go talk with Attila, the lead of which is Leo. Now, we don't know exactly what happens in the discussion with Leo and Attila. The people who write about it at least a century later, and there's writings that say that Attila saw an angel when Leo got there. Not real sure, but whatever happened, Attila withdraws. And he withdraws completely. There are at least three other factors that probably go into it. There was a famine in the land, and when you've got a military that large, you don't bring MREs, right? Meals ready to eat. You eat the crops of the land, right? And there was a famine, so it was hard for him to support his people. There was a plague coming through at the same time, and then the Gauls, the Franks, were coming in. They had called for support, and they were coming in as well. For whatever reason, if it's because of Leo's prowess, if it's because of these other reasons, whatever happens, Attila withdraws. And so Leo is really looked at as a hero. But Attila, in order to withdraw, says you have to pay 75,000 pounds, 7,000 pounds of gold, Roman pounds, by the way, not normal, not our pounds. A Roman pound is about 3/4 of our pound, about 12 ounces. And a Roman pound is called a libra, which is why in the zodiac, it's the, you know, the thing that looks like a scale that you would weigh a pound is called a libra. It's also why the shorthand for pound is LB, libra, right? So 7,000 of those plus 2,500 annually, right? And so he goes off, right? Here's annual payment, 2,500 pounds of gold, one-time tax, 7,000 pounds of gold. Oh, and by the way, I need the daughter of the Eastern Emperor as my bride, right? So, okay, whatever you say, Attila, take it and go. Well, when he leaves, guess what happens? Someone take a guess. They don't pay. That's right. They don't pay. Now, you know, there's a saying of like, fool me once, shame on me. No, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I'm not sure when you get to fool me four times. I don't know what happens there. Shame on somebody, and I don't know who gets shamed. But for the fourth time in a row, Attila comes back, and this time, supposedly, he's really angry. He is going to, like, raise Italy, basically. And in the providence of the Lord, on his way through, he meets some German girl and gets married. Right now, this is not the first time he's gotten married. He has dozens of wives, right? But he gets married, and in the feast that follows, he gets extremely inebriated. So inebriated that when he falls asleep that night and he has a nosebleed, as he was prone to do, he can't wake up. And so he chokes to death on his own blood and dies. Stay in school, don't do drugs. Do next after school special for the kids, Attila. Attila's son comes up at that point and tries to lead the Huns, but as often happens in history, when you get a strong charismatic leader, the son is unable to live up. And so within a year, the Huns have been destroyed, and the Huns go back somewhere in Russia, Turkey, that area, and they don't bother the empire again. So that's the Huns. Their big contribution, two things. One, that Leo successfully negotiated with them when everyone was scared of them, really brings up the view of the church and of church leadership in the eyes of the laity. Not only can they fix church problems, they can fix secular problems. They can fix real world problems. People are going to come and kill us problems. Okay. And secondly, they are the ones who kind of start that whole migration, and then you're going to deal with that for the next 400 years. So, after the Huns, you have the Vandals. The Vandals are a Germanic tribe. You can see on the map, instead of coming straight across, they take kind of a circuitous route. Instead of coming straight across into Italy, which is difficult because of those whole Alps things, right? They're kind of difficult to traverse. They come down through Spain, over into North Africa, all the way back over, and then up through southern Italy, right? Kind of around your elbow to get to your nose.
Josh, random question.
Yes.
What are the belief systems of these?
That's a good question. Okay, so they would be largely pagan as this whole thing starts off. And by pagan, I don't mean like, we talked about pagans earlier being like country folk, right? Pagans as in they have some belief system that's not Christian, not monotheist. What happens, we'll see this with the Vandals here, as they mix and mingle with the empire, they become Christian. And what happens is because they become Christian, all of a sudden their ability for bloodlust and their ability to ransack things diminishes greatly. A lot of the monasteries we talked about when we talked about monks, they're out there on the frontier. And so they're defending themselves, but they're also out there trying to make disciples. And so they're doing a very good job. And the heretics, a lot of times, they get pushed out of the empire mainstream, and they end up out here on the frontier. So when people come in, we'll talk about the Visigoths, I believe. They're Arian. And Arian, Jesus was just below God, right? There was when he was not. He's kind of God, but he's just below God because they want to preserve monotheism. So they're Arian. Even by the time they get to the emperor, they're already Arian. They're already Christian in that sense, right? So Christianity is starting to take this whole area by force or by storm. You're not quite there yet, but as they integrate with the empire, they become more and more Christians. Does that make sense? Any other questions? Okay. So Vandals come, kind of circuitous, up through southern Italy. Don't forget that Leo had solved a problem for North Africa where they had had an internal power struggle inside the church, and he had gone down and he had mediated. And by mediating that power struggle, the North Africans were able to defend themselves against the Vandals better. So Leo had some sense, A, that the Vandals were coming, and B, kind of helped get the Vandals closer to himself by getting the North Africans to the point where they could kick him out. They had a reputation for murder, rape, pillaging, and burning. Right? These were not guys that you wanted to come across. If there were a group of Vandals outside of Jackson, we would expect them to come in, take all of our wealth, kill every male, rape every woman under the age of, say, 12 or 13, they would carry off. The rest of them, they would kill you after they got done raping you. And then they would burn everything else. Right? That's the thing. So when Leo then negotiates with them and gets them to only come in and take their stuff, that is huge. Right? Later, in the Renaissance, the cry of the Renaissance is get back to the originals. Right? We want to get back to the original languages. We want to get back to the original thinkers. So the Southern Renaissance, they're trying to trace what happened kind of before Christendom, right? Because they see the church as being the problem, the thing that darkened intellect. And so they're trying to get before the church age. And as they find things, they find that the art, the statues have their heads cut off. They have all kinds of things wrong with them. Well, it's the Vandals. The Vandals had come through, and they had carried these things off as a part of their pillaging, right? And so in the Renaissance, they coined the phrase vandalize, right? Because that's what they did to all these pieces of art that they were trying to trace back to the early Romans. So they try to attack Rome. Like we said, Leo does a good job. He steps in, he negotiates with them, gets them to just take off with their stuff and not to kill and murder, or at least to diminish the amount of murdering. I don't think they went without it at all. The Vandals continue to be a problem for the next 30 or 40 years, and the East and West come together in what is kind of one of their last big collaborations. They both build fleets, and they try to take on the Vandals at sea. To destroy this fleet of Vandals and to secure their empire. Instead, the Vandals rout them and start throwing, they amass the bodies and start throwing them off so that they wind up on the shore of North Africa and Italy as a warning to let them know that they're coming. So just devastating psychologically to the people of the empire to see all these sailors washing ashore. So the East and West, because their fleet is decimated, they have no more options, they decide to do what they did with Attila. We'll pay you. Just leave us alone. Right? And so they pay tribute to the Vandals. And within 20 years, there's not really a record of whether or not their payment, they actually paid them or not, at least not that I saw. But within 20 years, the Vandals have become largely Christian. And because they've become largely Christian, they're no longer as violent as they were before. And so the Vandal threat really goes away, and it goes away by means of evangelism, not by means of military. That's not amazing. So that gets us all the way up into the 470s. Almost immediately, as the Vandals are fading, you have another group called the Berbers. The Berbers are a small tribe, but a fierce tribe, and that's where we get the word barbarian from. Now, it's tough with the word barbarian because the West starts calling everyone pretty much a barbarian if you're not Roman, right? That word, just like any word in any culture, can mean something specific, and then over time it can begin to generalize. Barbarian does the same. But at first, it just means those from this tribe of Berber. So this barbarian, this Berber warrior, takes Ravenna, kills the emperor, and sits on the throne. This is the year 476, and this is the year that history will say that the Roman Empire died. That's it. No more Roman Empire. 476. You have a barbarian sitting on the throne. His name is Odoacer. Odoacer actually begins to get along relatively well with both the church and the Senate in Rome. He's not looking so much to kill and pillage as he is just to have power. And he realizes that working with these two bodies is more beneficial to that end than taking them on. So he begins to actually enjoy some support. The problem is the East does not like that whatsoever. First off, he's not one of ours. Second off, the West was still paying the East. Remember, there was the East and there was the West. There was an Eastern Emperor, Western Emperor. The West reported to the East. And so this guy, once he took the throne, he stopped reporting to the East. He stopped taking orders and he stopped paying. And the East does not like this whatsoever. So they send messengers to the Visigoths. And he tells them, I will give you all of Italy if you will get rid of Odoacer. I don't know that he really cleared that with the Italians before he said that. But that's what he says. And so Theodoric, who is the commander of the Visigoths, he comes through and he begins to take on Odoacer. Theodoric beats Odoacer in two big significant battles. It looks as if Odoacer is going to lose and be wiped out. Theodoric sends his highest commander, an elite group of commandos, to finish him off. And somehow, rather than finishing him off, his commander, along with the commandos and his command, switch sides. Right? And then they come and they attack Theodoric, and it looks like Theodoric is going to lose. All of a sudden, Odoacer presses the attack. He's got all kinds of wonderful intelligence now, great double agent sort of stuff. HBO should do a special. And then the Visigoths come in. The Ostrogoths come in. And in one of the only instances of the Goth clans, the major Goth clans, Ostrogoth and Visigoth, coming together, they come in and rescue their kinsmen. Okay? And so now the Goths are unified against Odoacer. And this is a big problem. Odoacer may have been able to take on one, but he's not going to be able to take on both. So he retreats. He retreats to Ravenna. And again, that's where the capital was at. And again, because it's marshy, hard to get to. And there is a war that lasts 3.5 years. Gets us all the way up to 492. It takes 3.5 years for the Goths to finally build up their fleet enough. They have to basically make flatter bottom boats that can get through this marshy stuff. And it takes them 3.5 years to be able to build up this fleet so that they can actually get in and penetrate and siege Ravenna. On the eve of Ravenna following, the local bishop negotiates a peace treaty between the two where he's allowed to come in, Theodoric's allowed to come in, and the two are to co-reign together. Again, notice who it is who negotiates the peace treaty. It's not the East. It's not some other politician. It's the local bishop, right? You see that the church is continuing to serve in state functions. Unfortunately for Odoacer, Theodoric never intended to actually co-reign. So he sets up an ambush, and he's going to kill him by way of poison, and then if not by poison, I think by archers at a particular gathering. At the last minute, Odoacer decides to change where they're going to eat, right? And so I don't know if he got a tip off, but he changes, and so Theodoric takes out a sword and kills him. And so that's the end of Odoacer. There's actually a modern day opera about this. Oh, and the name of it's escaping me. I want to say it's. Now, I'd lie to you if I tried to tell you. There's a modern day opera, and this becomes like the big peak point when he kills him and sings some big song. So, if anyone knows what that is, feel free to tell me. We've got a whole bunch of opera fans in here, I'm sure. Okay, so the West is now under Ostrogoth rule. Remember, the East had said you can have all of Italy if you take it, right? So they expect that the Ostrogoths will pay back to the East, and they're wrong. right? They also expected the Italians to prefer being ruled by the East than being preferred to be ruled by the Goths. And they're wrong. The Ostrogoths, by the time they get there, they're Arians. They like the church, right? They support the church. They actually support the Senate as well. They saw what Odoacer was doing, and they just continue that same program. The church isn't quite as keen on the Ostrogoths because they are Arian after all, and that is a heresy. But they're not at the point where they're ready to like take up arms and try and kick him out. They just want to convert him, you know? So the people actually get along fine with the Goths. This does not sit well with the East. This is not what they wanted. And so they start a war to recapture the West. This is a war that will take decades, nearly 20 years, for them to recapture the West. During that time, it wreaks absolute havoc on the local economy of Italy and the West. It wreaks havoc on the political infrastructure. Again, we were talking about this earlier. When you wage war, you eat the crops of whatever nation you're in. You don't bring them along with you. Well, think about that for 20 years and what that would do to people. We get tired of war at about the 18-month mark, right? We send people to war, and then somewhere around 18 months we go, when is it going to be over? Right? Imagine something on our own soil that lasts 20 years. By the time this is over, the East wins. But how do you think the Italians are feeling towards the East? Not real gracious, right? They don't really care for the East very much. And then you end up with another group. Another group comes from over the Alps down into Italy, and they're called the Lombards. The Lombards will be a problem for 150 years. Okay? They'll come down and they'll raid the northern villages of Italy. And about 2 years after they start, another pope comes up, a pope by the name of Gregory. He's Gregory the Great, one of the other greats that come up. We'll talk about some of the other monikers next week that the popes begin to get when we talk about kind of the dark age of the popes. But just to give you a preview, some of them get called like the fat, the bald, the stammerer, right? Seriously, at this point they're still called the Great. It gives you some idea of what the people think of their leaders. He does what Leo had done before him. He goes and he negotiates peace. Yes. Yes, they are still Christian.
But it's okay for them to attack the other Christians?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I guess their Christianity doesn't preclude war at that point on fellow Christians. So, this lasts for 150 years. Varying times, it's more intense than others. The Lombards will come down. They'll carry off people, carry off things, take over territory. By the time the Lombards are done, really there's only a small strip that the Eastern Empire still has of Italy. Italy is just... Think about this. Italy has had the Huns, the Vandals, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Barbarians, the East, and now the Lombards. I mean, what's left? Right? Not much. And so it's hard for them to defend themselves. They don't put much faith in the government. And again, they look towards the church to help them. So now we're all the way up into the 8th century. We're at 756 by a pope by the name of Pope Stephen II. So when the Lombard starts, 590 when they start, so this is 150 years later, you've got the people so fed up. They're like, do something, right? Help us out. So he makes a trek over the Alps into France to meet with the Franks. And he meets with a guy by the name of Pepin. And Pepin gives him his army to come and defend him against the Lombards. And once he beats the Lombards, because whose land should that be now? Well, it should be the Franks. Right? The Franks are the ones who came in and they defeated the Lombards. They're the ones who are able to... Because, I mean, I keep talking about in the sense of Italy and other countries just to give us geographic understanding. But nationality, the idea of a national identity, was nowhere on the radar screen at this point. Right? Nationalism doesn't rise for another couple of centuries. So the Franks should have this land. It should be their land. They defended it. They got rid of the Lombards. And instead, Pepin donates this land to the church and says, it's your land. Oh, and by the way, I will give you the resources to have a mercenary army. Anytime you need an army, you let me know. Right? So get this. It's not because the church was looking to become a world force. It's not like the church, because some people will give you that sense that the church this whole time has been here going, wah, ha, 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 right? I just can't wait to get my hands on guns and land, right, and be a world power, right? That did not happen at all. The Italians are hurting, and they go to the church, help us. They go, they negotiate someone to come and help them. And then the guy says, look, you need to be able to defend yourself. I'm going to give you the tools to defend yourself. And now the church has land, not just like little bitty monastery land and church land. We're talking entire states' land, right? Now she has to administer entire towns. These are people who are allegiance to me, right, as the Pope. And I've got to worry about how they get fed, and I've got to worry about taxes, and I've got to worry about all the things that local administration requires. Oh, and now I have an army, right? Doesn't that seem weird? That the church would have an army? Can you imagine Ligon commanding an army? I mean, I'm sure he would do a fantastic job. He's Ligon, right? But it does seem a little weird, you know. Don't pay your tithe, well, listen to the army. So the thing to take away from this, by the way, in order to donate this land, this large block of land, they wanted to find some sort of, what's the word I'm looking for, when it's happened before, precedent. They're looking for some sort of precedent to say it's okay. It's okay for you to donate land, right? And all of a sudden they find a document called the Donation of Constantine. Do you guys remember me talking about the Donation of Constantine when we talked about Constantine? No, of course you don't, because I didn't talk about it, because it's not real, right? It's a forgery. But the church finds the Donation of Constantine, which is a document supposedly written by Constantine that donated the entirety of the empire, east and west, to the church. And so they said, look, well, we already got this document that donated all this land, and we just kind of lost it, you know? Oops. You can donate this land to us. Later in the Renaissance, by the way, this becomes one of the very first text critical exercises. And it doesn't come from someone who's secular. It actually comes from inside the church. Inside the church herself, she looks at that document and she says, well, you know what? That language and that grammar is different than the language and the grammar of Constantine's day. So it's a forgery, right? The church has always been interested in truthfulness, right? And she will aim even at herself when it comes to it. But nonetheless, they are given a large swath of land that will become the papal states, and they are given the rights to an army. Just to give you an understanding of where we've come, we've come from the church where she is under persecution, where she has no advocate, where if you will not pinch a sacrifice to the emperor, you will die in a coliseum. We've come from there to the church now having hundreds of square miles under its authority and thousands, tens of thousands, and sometimes hundreds of thousands of men, armed men, at its disposal, which it will use to make war. Okay? Next week we'll talk about the dark age of the church and the papacy, because what happens is now that the Pope has bartered with Pepin, with this Frankish king, you end up with a group of popes that are more military commanders than they are churchmen, and who are more have more allegiance to the Franks than they do to Christ. Does that make sense? Questions? Yes.
Is this the precursor to the Vatican, or is this
to Vatican? What do you mean? Yeah, the Vatican as you would know it, there is Old St. Peter's. Old St. Peter's is the St. Peter's that was built by Constantine when he built the churches for the apostles and himself, right? And it's Old St. Peter's Basilica. When the papacy will move, and we'll spend a couple of weeks on this, the papacy will move from Rome to near France, a place called Avignon. When they come back, St. Peter's is in disrepair. They reestablish the papacy back at Rome from France, and once that finally gets reestablished, part of the big push is to build a new complex and to make this officially Rome, the seat, the place. It's not moving, right? And they'll go and start doing things like, this is where the selling of indulgences come up to help pay for the Vatican that you know, right? And really becomes one of the cruxes for Martin Luther when he writes his 95 Theses.
This is 1,000 years later.
Yeah. Other questions? All right, let me close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, Lord, ask that you would be with each and every one of us as we leave this week. If we talk about parenting things or we talk about church things, may it all be to your greater good, glory, and honor. Lord, ask that you would help us, that as we learn about your church, as we see where she begins to go wayward, Lord, that we would not just see them, that we would not just see a church, but we would see ourselves, that we would see our own heart, we would see our own weakness and desire to go the same way at times, Lord, that you would help us to rein that in and to live lives that bring you glory and honor. We love you with all of our hearts and pray this in your Son's name. Amen.